Chapter 11, Talk of Debts. The gateway was positioned so that Elaine seemed to be riding out of a hole in the wall against the street into a square marked out for safety by sand-filled wine barrels standing on the paving stones. Oddly, she could not feel a single woman channeling anywhere in the palace, though it housed more than 150 with the ability. Some would be stationed on the city's outer walls, of course, too far for her to sense anything short of a linked circle, and a few would be out of the city altogether. Yet someone in the palace was almost always using Saidar, whether to try forcing one of the captive Suldam to admit that she really could see weaves of the One Power, or simply to smooth the wrinkles from a shawl without heating an iron. Not this morning, though. Windfinder arrogance often matched the worst shown by any Aes Sedai, yet even that must be quashed by what they sensed. Elaine thought that if she climbed to a high window, she must be able to see the weaves of that great beacon, hundreds of leagues distant as they were. She felt like an ant that had just become aware of mountains, an ant comparing the spine of the world to the hills it had always held in awe. Yes, even the Windfinders must be walking small in the face of that. On the eastern side of the palace, and fronted on north and south by two-story-high stables of pure white stone, the queen's stable-yard traditionally was given over to the queen's personal horses and carriages, and she had hesitated over using it before the lion throne was acknowledged hers. The steps that led to the throne were as delicate as any court dance, and if the dance sometimes came to resemble a tavern brawl, you still had to make your steps with grace and precision in order to gain your goal. Claiming the perquisites before being confirmed had cost some women their chance to rule. In the end, she had decided it was not a transgression that would make her seem overproud. Besides, the queen's stable-yard was relatively small and had no other use. There were fewer people to keep away from an opening gateway here. In fact, when she entered it, the stone-paved yard was empty, apart from a single red-coated groom standing in one of the arched stable doorways, but he turned to give a shout inside, and dozens more came spilling out as she guided Fireheart clear of the marked-off square. After all, she might have returned with an entourage of powerful lords or ladies, or perhaps they just hoped she had. Kasela brought the guardswomen through the gateway and ordered most to dismount and see to their animals. She and half a dozen more remained in their saddles, keeping watch over the heads of the people afoot. Even here she would not leave Elaine unguarded, particularly here, where she faced more danger than in any manor she had visited. The Matheran men milled about, getting in the way of grooms and guards while gaping at the white stone balconies and colonnades that overlooked the yard, and the spires and golden domes visible beyond. The cold seemed less here than in the mountains. Refusing to let it touch her, as far as she could at present, did not make her totally unaware. But men and women and horses all still breathed faint plumes of mist. The odor of horse dung seemed strong, too, after the clean air of the mountains. A hot bath in front of a roaring fire would be welcome. Afterward, she would have to plunge back into the business of securing the throne, but right now a long soak would be just the thing. A pair of grooms ran to Fireheart. One took his bridle with a hurried curtsy for Elaine, more concerned with seeing that the tall gelding made no bother while Elaine dismounted than with making courtesies herself, and another who made his bow and remained bent with his hands making a stirrup for Elaine. Neither gave more than a glance at the view of a snow-covered mountain meadow where they would normally see a stone wall. The stable workers were accustomed to gateways by now. She had heard that they garnered drinks in the taverns by boasting of how often they saw the power used and the things they supposedly had seen done with it. Elaine could imagine what those tales sounded like by the time they reached Aramilla. She rather enjoyed the thought of Aramilla chewing her fingernails. As she set foot on the paving stones, a cluster of guardswomen appeared around her, in crimson hats with white plumes lying flat on the broad brims and lace-edged crimson sashes, embroidered with the white lion that slanted across their bright breastplates. Not until then did Casella take the remainder of Elaine's escort to the stable. Their replacements were just as wary, eyes watching every direction, hands hovering near their sword hilts, except for Denny, a wide, placid-faced woman who carried a long, brass-studded cudgel. They were only 9 in number. Only 9, Elaine thought bitterly. I need only 9 bodyguards in the royal palace itself. Yet everyone who carried a sword was expert. Women who followed the trade of the sword, as Casella called it, had to be good, or else sooner or later they were cut down by some fellow whose only advantage was strength enough to batter her down. Denny possessed no facility with a sword at all, but the few men who had tested her cudgel regretted doing so. Despite her bulk, Denny was very quick, and she had no concept of fighting fair, or of practice, for that matter. Rasoria, the stocky under-lieutenant in charge, seemed relieved when the grooms led Fireheart off. If Elaine's bodyguard had their way, no one except themselves would have been allowed within arm's reach. Well, maybe they were not quite that bad, but they looked with suspicion at almost everyone except Birgitta and Avienda. Rasoria, a tyrant despite her blue eyes and the yellow hair she wore cut short, was among the worst in that regard, even insisting on watching the cooks make Elaine's meals and having everything tasted before it was brought up. Elaine had not protested, however overzealous they might be. One experience of drugged wine was more than enough, even when she knew she would live at least long enough to bear her child. But it was neither the guardswomen's mistrust nor the need for it that tightened her mouth. It was Birgitta, weaving her way through the crowded stable yard, but not toward her. Avienda was last to appear out of the gateway, of course, after she was sure that everyone was through, and before she let the gateway wink out of existence, Elaine started in her direction, striding off so suddenly that her escort had to leap to maintain their guarding ring around her. As quickly as she moved, though, Birgitta, with her thick golden braid hanging to her waist, was there first, helping Avienda down and handing the grey mare over to a long-faced groom who seemed almost as leggy as Siswai. Avienda always had more difficulty getting off a horse than getting on, but Birgitta had more than assistance in mind. Elaine and her escort arrived just in time to hear the woman say to Avienda in a low, hurried voice, "Did she drink her goat's milk? Did she get enough sleep? She feels..." Her voice trailed off at the end, and she drew a deep breath before turning to face Elaine, outwardly calm and unsurprised to find her right there. The bond did work both ways. Birgitta was not a big woman, though she stood taller than Elaine in her heeled boots, as tall as Avienda, but she usually had a presence that was only heightened by the uniform of the Captain General of the Queen's Guards, a short red coat with a high white collar, worn over baggy blue trousers tucked into gleaming black boots, 4 golden knots on her left shoulder, and 4 bands of gold on each white cuff. After all, she was Birgitta Silverbow, a hero out of legend. She remained wary of trying to live up to those legends. She claimed that the stories were grossly inflated where they were not complete fabrications. Yet she was still the same woman who had done every one of the things that formed the heart of those legends, and more besides. Now, despite her apparent composure, unease tinged the concern for Elaine that flowed through the bond along with her headache and her sullen stomach. She knew very well that Elaine hated for them to check on her behind her back. That was not the whole reason for Elaine's irritation, but the bond let Birgitta know just how upset she was. Avienda, calmly unwrapping her shawl from around her head and draping it over her shoulders, attempted the gaze of a woman who had done nothing wrong, and certainly was not involved with anyone else who had done anything wrong. She might have managed it if she had not widened her eyes for an added touch of innocence. Birgitta was a bad influence on her in some ways. "I drank the goat's milk," Elaine said in a level voice, all too conscious of the guardswomen ringing the 3 of them. Facing outward, eyes scanning the yard and the balconies and the rooftops, nearly every one was certainly listening. "I got enough sleep. Is there anything else you want to ask me?" Avienda's cheeks colored faintly. I think I have all the answers I need for the moment, Birgitta replied, without a hint of the blush Elaine had been hoping for. The woman knew she was tired, knew she had to be lying about the sleep. The bond was decidedly inconvenient at times. She had drunk nothing but half a cup of extremely well-watered wine last night, but she was beginning to have Birgitta's morning-after head and her sour stomach. None of the other Aes Sedai she had spoken to about the bond had mentioned anything of the kind, but she and Birgitta all too often mirrored one another, physically and emotionally. The last presented real problems when her moods were on a seesaw. Sometimes she managed to shrug it off or fight it off, but today she knew she was going to have to suffer until Birgitta was healed. She thought the mirroring must occur because they were both women. No one had heard of anyone bonding another woman before. Few had heard of it now, to tell the truth, and some of them seemed to believe it could not be true. A warder was male as surely as a bull was male. Everyone knew that, and not many stopped to think that anything that everyone knew deserved close examination. Being caught in a lie when she was trying to follow Egwene's dictate about living as if she had already taken the three oaths made Elaine defensive, and that made her blunt. "Is Dailan back?" "No," Birgitta said just as bluntly, and Elaine sighed. Dailan had left the city days before Aramilla's army appeared, taking Rhianna Corley with her to make gateways and speed her travel, and a great deal depended on Dailan's return. On what news she brought back? On whether she brought anything besides news? Choosing who would be Queen of Andor was quite simple, boiled down to essentials. There were over 400 houses in the realm, but only 19 strong enough that others would follow where they led. Usually all 19 stood behind the daughter heir, or most of them, unless she was plainly incompetent. House Mantiar had lost the throne to Trakand when Mordrellan died, only because Tigraine, the daughter heir, had vanished, and Mantiar had begun running heavily to boy children, and because Morghese Trakand had gathered 13 houses in her support. Only 10 of the 19 were necessary to ascend the throne by law and custom. Even claimants who still thought they should have the throne themselves usually fell in with the rest, or at least fell silent and gave up their pursuit, once another woman had 10 houses at her back. Things had been bad enough when she had 3 declared rivals, but now Nayan and Elania were united behind Aramilla Marn, of all people, the least likely of the 3 to have succeeded. And that meant she had 2 houses, 2 large enough to count. Matherin and those 18 others she had visited were too small, her own Trakand and Dailan's Taravin to face 6. Oh, Dailan insisted that Karand, Koalan, and Renshar would come to Elaine, and Norwellin and Pendar and Tremaine besides. But the first 3 wanted Dailan herself on the throne, and the last 3 seemed to have gone into hibernation. Dailan was firm in her loyalty, though, and tireless on Elaine's behalf. She persisted in her belief that some of the houses that were keeping silent could be convinced to support Elaine. Of course, Elaine could not approach them herself, but Dailan could. And now the situation verged on desperate. 6 houses supporting Aramilla, and only a fool would think she had not sent feelers out toward the others. Or that some might listen just because she did have 6 already. Despite the fact that Cassela and her guards had vacated the courtyard, Elaine and the others had to thread their way across the paving stones through a crowd. The men from Matherin were finally down off their horses, but they were still moiling about, dropping their halberds and picking them up only to drop them again, trying to unload their pack horse there in the stable yard. One of the boys was chasing a chicken that somehow had gotten loose and was scuttling between the horse's legs, while one of the wrinkled old men shouted encouragement, though whether for the boy or the chicken was unclear. A leather-faced bannerman with the merest fringe of white hair remaining in a faded red coat that strained across his belly was trying to establish order with the help of an only slightly younger guardsman, both of them likely returned from their pensions, as a good many had, but another of the boys seemed about to lead his shaggy horse into the palace itself, and Birgitta had to order him out of the way before Elaine could enter. The boy, A fuzz-cheeked lad, who could not have been above 14, gaped at Birgitta as widely as he had at the palace. She was certainly more picturesque in her uniform than the daughter heir in a riding dress, and he'd already seen the daughter heir. Rasoria gave him a shove back toward the old bannerman, shaking her head. "I don't flaming know what I can do with them," Birgitta grumbled, as a maid liveried in red and white took Elaine's cloak and gloves in the small entry hall. Small in terms of the royal palace. With gilded stand lamps flickering between narrow, fluted white columns, it was half again the size of Matherin's main entry hall, though the ceiling was not so high. Another maid with the white line on the left breast of her dress, a girl not that much older than the boy who had tried to bring his horse inside, offered a rope-work silver tray with tall cups of steaming spiced wine before simultaneous frowns from Avienda and Birgitta made her shy back. "The flaming boys fall asleep if they're put on guard," Birgitta went on, scowling at the retreating maid. "The old men stay awake but half can't remember what they're flaming supposed to do if they see somebody trying to scale the bloody wall, and the other half together couldn't fight off six shepherds with a dog." Avienda raised an eyebrow at Elaine and nodded. "They aren't here to fight," Elaine reminded them, as they started down a blue-tiled corridor, lined with mirrored stand lamps and inlaid chests, Birgitta and Avienda on either side of her, and the guardswomen spreading out a few paces ahead of them and behind. "Light," she thought. "I wouldn't have taken the wine." Her head pounded in rhythm with Birgitta's, and she touched her temple, wondering whether she should order her warder to go find healing immediately. Birgitta had other ideas, though. She eyed Rasoria and the others in front, then looked over her shoulder and motioned those following to fall back a little more. That was strange. She had hand-picked every last woman in the guards, and she trusted them. Even so, when she spoke, it was in a hurried near whisper, bending her head close to Elaine. "Something happened just before you returned. I was asking Sumiko if she'd heal me before you got back, and she suddenly fell over in a faint. Her eyes just rolled up in her head and down she went. It isn't only her. Nobody will admit a flaming thing, not to me, but the other kin I've seen have been jumping out of their bloody skins, and the Windfinders too. Not one of them could spit if she had to. You were back before I could find a sister, but I suspect they'd give me the fisheye too. They'll tell you, though." The palace required the population of a large village to keep running, and servants had begun to appear, liveried men and women scurrying along the corridors, flattening themselves against the wall or ducking into crossing hallways to make room for Elaine's escort, so she explained the little she knew in as soft a voice and as few words as possible. Some rumors she did not mind reaching the streets and inevitably Aramilla, but tales of Rand could be as bad as tales of the Forsaken by the time they were twisted through a few retellings. Worse, in a way. No one would believe the Forsaken were trying to put her on the throne as a puppet. "In any event," she finished, "it's nothing to do with us here." She thought she sounded very convincing, very cool and detached, but Avienda reached out to squeeze her hand. For an Aiel as much as a comforting hug with so many people to see, and Birgitta's sympathy flooded through the bond. It was more than commiseration. It was the shared feeling of a woman who had already suffered the loss she herself feared and more. Gaidal Kane was lost to Birgitta as surely as if he were dead, and on top of that, her memories of her past lives were fading. She remembered almost nothing clearly before the founding of the White Tower, and not all of that. Some nights the fear that Gaidal would fade from her memory too, that she would lose any remembrance of actually having known and loved him, left her unable to sleep until she drank as much brandy as she could hold. That was a poor solution, and Elaine wished she could offer a better. Yet she knew her own memories of Rand would not die until she did, and she could not imagine the horror of knowing those memories might leave her. Still, she hoped someone healed Birgitta's morning-after head soon before her own split open like an overripe melon. Her ability with healing fell short of the task, and Avienda's was no stronger. Despite the emotion she could feel in Birgitta, the other woman kept her face smooth and unconcerned. "The Forsaken," she muttered dryly. And softly. That was not a name to bandy about. "Well, as long as it has nothing to do with us, we're bloody all right." A grunt that might have been a laugh gave her the lie. But then, although Birgitta said she had never been a soldier before, she had a soldier's view. Long odds were usually the only odds you could find, but she still had to get the job done. "I wonder what they think of it," she added, nodding toward the four-eyed Sedai who had just stepped out of a crossing corridor down the hallway. Vandine, Marilla, Saritha, and Kariana had their heads together as they walked. Or rather, the last three were clustered around Vandine, leaning toward her and talking with urgent gestures that made the fringes on their shawls sway. Vandine glided along slowly as if she were alone, paying no heed. She'd always been slender, but her dark green dress, embroidered with flowers on the sleeves and shoulders, hung on her as though made for a stouter woman, and the white hair gathered at the nape of her neck seemed in need of a brush. Her expression was bleak, but that might have had nothing to do with whatever the other sisters were saying. She had been joyless ever since her sister's murder. Elaine would have wagered that dress had belonged to Adelius. Since the murder, Vandine wore her sister's clothes more often than her own. Not that that accounted for the fit. The two women had been of a size, but Vandine's appetite for food had died with her sister. Her taste for most things seemed to have died then. Saritha, a brown whose dark, square face was not yet touched with agelessness, saw Elaine just then and put a hand on Vandine's arm as if to draw her up the corridor. Vandine brushed the Tyran woman's hand away and glided on with the merest glance at Elaine, disappearing on along the hallway they had come out of. Two women in novice white, who had been following the others at a respectful distance, offered quick curtsies to the remaining sisters and hastened after Vandine. Marilla, a tiny woman in dark gray that made her Kyrianan paleness seem like ivory, stared as if she might follow. Kariana adjusted her green-fringed shawl on shoulders wider than those of many men and exchanged quiet words with Saritha. The pair of them turned to meet Elaine as she approached, making her curtsies almost as deep as the novices had given them. Marilla noticed the guardswomen and blinked, then noticed Elaine and gave a start. Her curtsy matched the novices. Marilla had worn the shawl for over 100 years, Kariana for more than 50, and even Saritha had worn it longer than Elaine Trakand, but standing among Aes Sedai went with strength in the power, and none of these three was more than middling strong among sisters. In Aes Sedai eyes, increased strength gave, if not increased wisdom, at least increased weight to your opinions. With a sufficient gap, those opinions became commands. Sometimes Elaine thought the kin's way was better. "I don't know what it is," she said, before any of the other Aes Sedai could speak. "But there is nothing we can do about it, so we might as well quit worrying. We have enough right in front of us without fretting over things we can't affect." Rosoria half turned her head, frowning and plainly wondering what she had missed, but the words smoothed the anxiety from Saritha's dark eyes. Perhaps not from the rest of her, since her hands moved as if she wanted to smooth her brown skirts, yet she was willing to follow the lead of a sister who stood as high as Elaine. Sometimes there were advantages to standing high enough that you could quell objections with a sentence. Kariana had already regained serenity, if she had ever lost it. It sat easily on her, though she looked more like a wagon driver than an Aes Sedai, despite her beryl-slashed silks and smooth, ageless, coppery face. But then, greens usually were made of tougher stuff than browns. Marilla did not look at all serene. Wide eyes and half-parted lips gave her the appearance of startlement. That was usual for her, though. Elaine continued along the hallway, hoping they would go about their business, but Marilla fell in beside Birgitta. The grey should have taken primacy among the three, but she had developed a tendency to wait for someone to tell her what to do, and she shifted over without a word when Sarita politely asked Birgitta to give her room. The sisters were unfailingly courteous to Elaine's warder when she was acting as Captain General. It was Birgitta as warder they tried to ignore. Aviendo received no such civility from Kariana, who elbowed in between her and Elaine. Anyone not trained in the White Tower was a Wilder by definition, and Kariana despised Wilders. Avienda pursed her lips, though she did not draw her belt knife or even suggest that she might, for which Elaine was grateful. Her first sister could be precipitate at times. On second thought, she would have forgiven a little hastiness from Avienda right then. Custom forbade rudeness toward another Aes Sedai under any circumstances, but Avienda could have growled threats and waved her knife to her heart's content. That might have been enough to make the threesome leave, even if in a tizzy. Kariana did not seem to notice the cool green gaze marking her. "I told Marilla and Sarita it was nothing we could do anything about," she said calmly. "But shouldn't we be ready to flee if it comes closer? There's no shame flying from that. Even linked, we would be moths fighting a forest fire. Van Deen wouldn't bother to listen." "We really should make some sort of preparations, Elaine," Sarita murmured absently, as if making lists in her head. "It's when you don't make plans that you wish you had. There are a number of volumes in the library here that mustn't be left behind. I believe several can't be found in the tower library." "Yes." Marilla's voice was breathless and as anxious as her large dark eyes. "Yes, we really should be ready to go. Perhaps we should not wait. Surely going from necessity would not violate our agreement. I am sure it would not." Only Birgitta as much as glanced at her, but she flinched.
"If we do go," Kariana said, as if Marilla had not spoken, "we'll have to take all of the kin with us. Allow them to scatter, and the light only knows what they'll do or when we will ever catch them again, especially now that some have learned to travel."
There was no bitterness in her voice, though only Elaine among the sisters in the palace could travel. It seemed to make a difference to Kariana that the kinswomen had begun in the White Tower, even if most had been put out and a few had run away. She had identified no fewer than four of them herself, including one runaway. At least they were not Wilders. Saritha's mouth tightened, though. It weighed on her that several kinswomen could weave gateways, and she had very different notions of the kin. Normally she limited her objections to the occasional frown or disparaging grimace, since Elaine had made her own views clear, but the stress of the morning seemed to have loosened her tongue. "We do indeed need to take them with us," she said in a cutting tone, "else they'll all be claiming to be Aes Sedai as soon as they're out of our sight. Any woman who maintains she was put out of the tower over 300 years ago will claim anything. They need to be kept under a close watch, if you ask me, instead of going about as they please, most especially those who can travel. They may have gone where you told them and come back so far, Elaine, but how long before one of them doesn't return? Mark my words. Once one of them escapes, others will follow, and we will have a mess on our hands we'll never clean up."
"There is no reason for us to go anywhere," Elaine said firmly, as much for the guards as for the sisters. That distant beacon was still in the same spot where she had first sensed it, and if it did move, the chance seemed small that it would move toward Camelin, much less actually come there. But a rumor that Aes Sedai were planning flight might be enough to engender a stampede, mobs clawing to reach the gates ahead of whatever could frighten Aes Sedai. An army sacking the city would not kill as many. And these three chattered away as if there were no one to hear but the wall hangings. There was some excuse for Marilla, but not the others. "We will remain here as the Ummerlin seat has commanded until the Ummerlin commands otherwise. The kinswomen will continue to receive every courtesy until they are welcomed back into the tower, and that is the Ummerlin's command too, as you very well know. And you will continue teaching the Windfinders and go about your lives as Aes Sedai should. We are supposed to deal with people's fears and soothe them, not spread senseless gossip and panic."
Well, perhaps she had been a touch more than firm. Sarita put her gaze on the floor tiles like a rebuked novice. Marilla flinched again at mention of the Windfinders, but that was to be expected.
The others gave lessons, but the sea folk held Merilla as tightly as they did one of their apprentices. She slept in their quarters and normally was not seen without two or three of them, and her trailing meekly at their heels. They refused to accept anything less than meekness from her.
"Of course, Elaine," Kariana said hastily, "of course. None of us would suggest disobeying the Amarlin."
Hesitating, she adjusted her green-fringed shawl over her arms, seemingly occupied with setting it just so. She did spare a pitying look for Merilla.
"But speaking of the sea folk, could you tell Van Deen to take her share of the lessons?"
When Elaine said nothing, her voice took on an edge that would have been called sullen in anyone not Aes Sedai.
"She says she's too busy with those two runaways, but she finds enough time to keep me talking some nights until I'm half asleep. That pair is already so cowed they wouldn't squeak if their dresses caught fire. They don't need her attention. She could take her portion of teaching those cursed wilders. Van Deen needs to start behaving as an Aes Sedai, too."
Standing or no, rebuke or no, she gave Elaine a baleful glare that took her a moment to smother. Elaine had been the one who made the bargain that led to Aes Sedai having to teach Windfinders, but so far she herself had managed to miss giving more than a handful of lessons, claiming the press of other more important duties. Besides, the sea folk saw a shore-bound teacher as a hireling, even an Aes Sedai, and a hireling with less standing than a scullion at that, a scullion who might try to cheat on her labor. She still thought Nynaeve had gone away just to avoid giving those lessons. Certainly no one expected to end up in Merilla's state, but even a few hours at a time was bad enough.
"Oh no, Kariana," Saritha put in, still avoiding Elaine's eye, and Merilla's.
In her opinion, the Grey had gotten herself into this fix and thus deserved what came of it, but she did try not to rub salt in the wounds.
"Van Deen is distraught over her sister, and Kirstian and Zarya help her occupy her mind."
Whatever she thought of the other kin, she accepted that Zarya was a runaway, as she had to, since Zarya was one of those Kariana had recognized, and if Kirstian must be a liar, her own lie would make her pay in full for that. Runaways were not treated kindly. "I spend hours with her, too, and she almost never talks of anything but Adelius. It's as if she wants to add my memories to her own. I think she needs to be allowed as much time as she needs, and those two keep her from being alone too often." Giving Elaine a sidelong glance, she drew breath.
"Still, teaching the Windfinders is certainly challenging. Perhaps an hour now and then would help pull her out of despondency, if only by making her angry. Don't you agree, Elaine? Just an hour or two now and then?"
"Van Deen will be allowed as much time to grieve for her sister as she needs or wants," Elaine said in level tones, "and there will be no more discussion of it." Kariana sighed heavily and rearranged her shawl again. Saritha sighed faintly and began twisting the great serpent ring on the forefinger of her left hand. Perhaps they had sensed her mood, or perhaps it was just that neither looked forward to another session with the Windfinders. Merilla's permanently surprised expression did not change, but then her sessions with the sea folk lasted all day and all night, unless Elaine managed to pry her away, and the Windfinders were becoming less and less willing to let her go, no matter how Elaine pried. At least she had managed to avoid being curt with the three. It took an effort, especially with Avienda there. Elaine did not know what she would do if she ever lost her sister. Van Deen was not only grieving for a sister, she was searching for Adelius's murderer, and there could be no doubt that the killer was Merilla Cian Devon, Kariana Franci, or Saritha Tomaras. One of them, or worse, more than one. The charge was hard to believe of Merilla in her present condition, but it was not easy to believe of any sister. As Birgitta had pointed out, one of the worst dark friends she had ever met during the Trolloc Wars was a mild-as-milk lad who jumped at loud noises and poisoned an entire city's water supply. Avienda's suggestion was to put all three to the question, which had horrified Birgitta, but Avienda was considerably less in awe of Aes Sedai than she once had been, The proper courtesies must be maintained until there was evidence to convict. Then there would be no courtesy at all.
"Oh," Saritha said, brightening suddenly, "here's Captain Mellar. He was a hero again while you were gone, Elaine."
Avienda gripped the hilt of her belt knife and Birgitta stiffened. Kariana's face went very still, very cold, and even Marilla managed a disapproving hauteur. Neither sister made any secret of her dislike for Doylen Mellar. With a narrow face, he was not pretty or even handsome, yet he moved with a swordsman's lithe grace that spoke of physical strength. As captain of Elaine's bodyguard, he rated 3 golden knots of rank, and he wore them soldered to each shoulder of his brightly burnished breastplate. An ignorant observer might have thought he outranked Birgitta. The falls of snow-white lace at his throat and wrists were twice as thick and twice as long as those worn by any of the guardswomen, but he had left off the sash again, perhaps because it would have obscured one set of golden knots. He claimed that he wanted nothing more in life than to command her bodyguard, yet he frequently talked of battles he had fought as a mercenary. It seemed he had never been on the losing side, and victory had often come from his unsung efforts on the field. He swept off his white-plumed hat in a deep, flourishing bow, managing his sword deftly with one hand, then offered a slightly lesser to Birgitta, with an arm across his chest in salute. Elaine arranged a smile on her face.
"Saritha says you were a hero again, Captain Mellar. How so?"
"Nothing more than my duty to my queen."
Despite a voice thick with self-deprecation, his answering smile was warmer than it should have been. Half the palace thought him the father of Elaine's child. That she had not crushed that rumor seemed to make him believe he had prospects. The smile never reached his dark eyes, though. They remained as cold as death.
"My duty to you is my pleasure, my queen."
"Captain Mellar led another sortie without orders yesterday," Birgitta said in a carefully even voice. This time the fighting almost spilled into the farm-adding gate, which he had ordered left open against his return. Elaine felt her face growing hard.
"Oh, no," Saritha protested. "It wasn't like that at all. 100 of Lord Luan's armsmen tried to reach the city in the night, but they left it too late, and sunrise caught them. So did 3 times their number of Lord Nason's men. If Captain Mellar hadn't opened the gates and led a rescue, they'd have been cut to pieces inside of the walls. As it was, he managed to save 80 for your cause."
Smiling, Mellar basked in the Aes Sedai's praise as if he had not heard Birgitta's criticism. Of course, he seemed unaware of Kariana and Marilla's disapproving stares, too. He always managed to ignore disapproval.
"How did you know they were Lord Luan's men, Captain?"
Elaine asked quietly. A small smile that should have given Mellar warning appeared on Birgitta's face. But then he was one of those who seemed not to believe she was a warder. Even if he did, few except warders and Aes Sedai knew what the bond entailed. If anything, Mellar's expression grew more smug.
"I didn't go by banners, my queen. Anybody can carry a banner. I recognize Jurad Akan through my looking-glass. Akan is Luan's man to his toenails. Once I knew that..."
He made a dismissive gesture in a flurry of lace.
"The rest was no more than taking a little exercise."
"And did this Jurad Akan bring any message from Lord Luan? Anything signed and sealed, affirming House Norwellen's support for Trakand?"
"Nothing in writing, my queen, but as I said,
Lord Luan has not declared for me, Captain."
Mellar's smile faded somewhat. He was unused to being cut short.
"But, my queen, Lady Dialin says that Luan is as good as in your camp right now. Akan showing up is proof of..."
"Of nothing, Captain," Elaine said coldly. "Perhaps Lord Luan will be in my camp eventually, Captain, but until he declares, you've given me 80 men who need to be watched."
80 out of 100. And how many of hers had he lost?
And he had risked Camelin doing it, burn him.
"Since you can find time in your duties commanding my bodyguard to lead sorties, you can find time to arrange for watching them. I won't spare anyone from the walls for it. Set Master Akan and his fellows to drilling the men I've brought in from the manors. That will keep them all busy and out of trouble most of each day, but I leave it to you how to keep them away from the walls the rest of the time. And I do expect them kept away from the walls and out of trouble, Captain. You may see to it now." Melar stared at her, stunned. She had never taken him to task before, and he did not like it, particularly in front of so many witnesses. There were no overwarm smiles now. His mouth twitched, and a sullen heat grew in his eyes. But there was nothing for him to do except to jerk another bow, murmur, "As my queen commands," in a hoarse voice, and leave with as good a grace as he could muster. Before he had gone 3 paces, he was striding down the hall as if to trample anyone who got in his way. She would have to tell Rosoria to take care. He might try to soothe his bile by taking it out on those who had seen and heard. Marilla and Kariana gave almost identical nods. They would have seen Melar called down and preferably put out of the palace long since. "Even if he did wrong," Saritha said carefully, "and I'm not convinced that he did, Captain Melar saved your life, at risk to his own, Elaine, your life and that of the Lady Dialin. Was there really need to embarrass him in front of the rest of us?" "Never think I avoid paying my debts, Saritha." Elaine felt Avienda grip one of her hands and Birgitta the other. She gave each of them a light squeeze. When you were surrounded by enemies, it was good to have a sister and a friend close by. "I am going to find a hot bath now, and unless one of you wishes to scrub my back?" They could recognize a dismissal, and they departed more gracefully than Captain Melar, Kariana and Saritha already discussing whether or not the Windfinders would actually want lessons today, Marilla trying to look every direction at once, in hope of avoiding any Windfinders. What would they talk of later, though? Whether Elaine was having a spat with the father of her child? Whether they had successfully hidden their guilt in killing Adelius? "I always pay my debts," Elaine thought, watching them go. "And I help my friends pay theirs."